Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monocle's programme all about the built environment. I'm your host, Andrew Tuck. Coming up...
People just have an instinctive nature to just act on something and do something that will help or will support or will try and heal or unify and connect. And it just so happened that gardening would be the way in which I communicated myself.
How can tending a garden heal a community? On this week's episode, we speak to a guerrilla gardener who's using his green thumbs to help build communities and encouraging other, perhaps less likely horticulturists to get down and dirty too. Then we explore the woes and wonders of winter cycling as we compare how countries who are fairly familiar with freezing temperatures embrace their freewheeling citizens. Plus, a look at Austria's proposed new tax designed to ensure housing stock in the country is fully utilised. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. First up today, we head out into the garden. Tayshan Hayden-Smith is on a mission to bring about a small-scale green revolution, engaging communities and embracing creativity through horticulture. Tayshan's new book, Small Space Revolution, explores the need for more outdoor green spaces, and his own real-life examples show how getting your hands dirty can be a healing, constructive and transformative experience for all involved. And I'm pleased to say I'm joined now by Tayshan Hayden-Smith. Tayshan, thank you so much for joining me today. You've actually gone on quite a unique journey from a career originally in football, now to gardening and activism. Can you describe that path you took to horticulture?
Gardening was never on the horizon, or was it even in my vocab? No, I don't think it really was. Horticulture definitely wasn't. And so reflecting on my upbringing, and this is not something I would have realized at the time, but I think my mum had a massive part to play in my admiration for nature. Like, she saw the world in art, you know, like she stopped in awe and curiosity at the littlest of things, you know, in such an urban inner city space. You know, we grew up in Ladbrook Grove. My mum was a single mother of four of us. We lived in a council house. And so you can imagine how chaotic and how hectic everything was. My mum somehow always managed to just pull things together and make sure that there was a routine, that there was a schedule, that we all had more than enough love and things to do to interest us and excite us. But one of the things that I do remember growing up is that my mum, yeah, really was sensitive to nature, not in like a outright, you know, quite vocal or even something that you could observe from the outside. I mean, my mum was very gentle, very soft, very kind-spirited. But I think that all played into how she viewed herself in the world and as part of the ecosystem. And it'll be just small things like walking in Ladbroke Grove. And, you know, like, this is my experience as a child. My mum would just stop in her tracks and look at the tree for a few seconds and go, "Kids, can you see the texture on the bark?" And sure enough, we'd all feel the tree and, you know, spend a few seconds observing and admiring the tree before we just got up to mischief again. And then sunsets was my mum's thing. Like, she used to really adore sunsets and like the many different colors, and she would query us on the different colors that we could see in the sunset. And I think those were moments in which she found peace and she found, I guess, beauty in nature, and that clearly rubbed off on me.
Well, it's also a remarkable part of London, Ladbroke Grove, but also a part of London that is marked by a terrible tragedy, because where you grew up was very close to Grenfell Tower, where there was this tragic, tragic fire that killed so many people. But again, somehow you saw in there a tiny part of a complicated healing process with the community, something that you could do via gardening. Could you just tell listeners about what happened there?
That's where I landed, but I wouldn't say that I kind of saw a route forwards or an opportunity, or like in a moment like that where something so, I guess, so heavy and so tragic and so traumatic happens so close to home. And, you know, people that I knew are no longer with us, and people that are still with us are traumatized by what happened. And that's something that we all have to live with for all of our lifetimes. And I guess for me, in the moments after Grenfell, I mean, I wasn't there necessarily when it started to happen, but I came back to absolute chaos in the morning of the fire, and it just stopped me in my tracks. I couldn't tell you what was going through my mind. I think if I was to describe how I was feeling, I think I was feeling very angry. I was feeling frustrated. I was feeling helpless. Like, there's not much you can do in a situation like that, but to, I guess, seek understanding, to seek solace, and to try and express those really, like, pent-up emotions and tensions within you. And I say this kind of reflecting on it, I wouldn't have been able to communicate this at the time or even in the years following, because things were just happening and you kind of go blank and you kind of go numb when something like Grenfell Tower claims 72 lives of people that you knew to be as neighbours and you knew to be as friends and used to play football with them and used to kind of engage with them, used to go around to their house, used to play with these people growing up, used to say hi to them on the street. And I just remember walking around in my area. And, you know, like you said, Ladbroke Grove is known as this vibrant, really eclectic, cultural melting pot of a place, very creative. And I'm so used to seeing joyful faces. And despite the adversity in the community and the social injustices and challenges like pre-Grenfell, you would be met with smiles and you'd be met with people welcoming and very happy. And that's the essence of the community in Ladbroke Grove. But all of a sudden, you know, walking down the street in Ladbroke Grove, there's a vacancy in emotion. You know, people were very, obviously, naturally very angry, very sad, and all those emotions that I explained that I felt at the time, everyone was feeling those emotions. And in those moments after Grenfell, it was important that we pulled together, and that whilst there was no strategy, there was no plan, and that could be said about any of the activisms, and probably something that could be said about activism in general following any tragedy. You know, people just have an instinctive nature to just act on something and do something that will help or will support or will try and heal or unify and connect. And it just so happened that gardening would be the way in which I communicated myself.
Teshan, you saw a piece of land that you began to tend and a story began there. So, as you say, no big plan or intention in the beginning. But just tell us a little bit about the gardening that began then.
Yeah, so, I mean, it didn't even start as gardening. It didn't even start as a garden. There was this derelict, barren patch of land in this red-bricked raised bed just offset of the motorway in a place called Maxilla. And Maxilla had become a place where people congregate because it was under the Westway and it was quite a sheltered space. People would sit there. People would kind of express themselves through art. So you'd get a lot of graffiti and artwork on walls where people would express themselves in that way. And you'd get young children painting pictures of burning buildings and people jumping out of them. And it was really emotive and very heavy. I saw this space, it was just filled with litter and rubbish, and I just decided I was going to tidy it up a bit and make it a bit more respectable and respectful. And I guess I thought that didn't really reflect my community in the way that I knew my community to be. So yeah, I started to litter pick, and I really couldn't pin down that moment where I decided, okay, we're going to find some plants. Again, I don't think I even used the word garden at that point, but I knew that the soil needed life, and we went and found that in local garden centres and local nurseries that were offering whatever they can. And there was what we called the Grenfell Garden of Peace, where everyone was welcome to make the garden what they wanted to make it. And it would be a safe space where people can connect and unify and even just have a chat, even just share a smile, share a tear, and just have a shoulder to lean on.
It's amazing the way that from all those years before when your mum had stopped when walking with all of you, and made you feel the bark and made you look at the leaves, you knew probably deep down inside somehow the healing potential of plants and of nature and of touch and of getting your hands dirty in the soil.
Yeah, I mean, whilst my mum would not sit us down and necessarily say these things, I think she was just a beautiful example of how nature can inspire and guide and steer and heal. And I think in a time of need, that's what saved me, is nature. Nature was what I turned to. And yeah, I guess that's an extension of my mum and her spirit. I guess then I became aware of the word gardening. I mean, I probably knew what it meant, but the word guerrilla gardener, I didn't know what that meant. And activism, I didn't know what that was. All these things that came up in conversation with people who would join in the garden. And that would really help build an idea of community and collaboration and coexistence and all these injustices and society and environment. All of these terms that you would never hear me say before, but the garden had become my classroom, my therapy space and my playground almost. This was a place that I could be creative, I could express myself. And what was very traumatic and very tragic at the time turned into something that was very transformative. And I didn't realize that for a while, but it just took kind of speaking to people in the community and kind of, I guess, channeling their energy and channeling their ideas and listening in to what they were saying and taking that forward in my ethos and my values. That's kind of how I really did embrace being a gardener. And it wasn't so easy to embrace that idea because I'm a young man, and typically you'd find me at the Westway Sports Centre, which is across the road, to the garden I was in, the guerrilla garden I was in, and like all my boys who were playing football there, who would usually expect me to be on the pitch with them, were suddenly coming out of the football pitch and seeing me with my hands in the soil. And I did feel like a bit embarrassed, a bit ashamed at the time. Like it was unfamiliar territory for me and it wasn't my natural setting, although I think it is at the time in my mind, it wasn't.
In the wake of the fire in 2017, as you say, 72 people would end up losing their lives from the fire. You then start Grow to Know Project, which is an attempt to break down the notion of who is a gardener and what gardening means and who has the right almost to claim the title and to love plants and be involved. Just tell us a little bit about Grow to Know.
Yeah, this is it. And it wasn't until 2020. My mum was terminally ill growing up. So I was maybe like 13 when my mum was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And she was given 3 months to live then. And I say that because my mum's passing had a lot to do with me bringing Grow to Know into the world. It was a week after my mum had passed when I launched Grow to Know, kind of without really much of an idea of what it was going to be. But I knew that something had to change and Grow to Know would be that vehicle in which we could try and implement that change. And so it's in the spirit of my mum. It was a moment of boldness and being brave where I said, you know what, mum would have wanted me to do this. She always used to tell me not to be consumed and dwell in negativity and channel that negative energy into something positive. And in those moments that my mum passed, I think, again, nature was what came to save me. And Grow to Know was kind of like, had become something that I could then channel all my energy into. And so Grow to Know was founded in 2020 in the midst of the pandemic, where we'd become a bit of a voice for the voiceless. I mean, I guess a relatively young person with two young children. I've got an 8-year-old and 5-year-old. And at the time, obviously, it's like 1 and 4. And so there we were in the pandemic in a council estate, kind of locked into a small flat. By that time, I enrolled at Cape of Manor College and wanted to know a bit more about plants and what I was speaking about and thinking about. But also my kids were doing homeschooling, like a lot of online learning. And so you can imagine how challenging that was at the time in a flat with two kids that couldn't go outside and none of us could go outside. So it was a real difficult time. But then because of where I live in the most affluent borough in the country, Kensington and Chelsea. So the experience of the pandemic is very different depending on who you're speaking to. And so for some people who had access to beautiful space and vast amounts of greenery in their front garden or their back garden or in their square, or maybe even they had a place abroad that they escaped to, the pandemic was like a dream year or two for some people. But the reality is that the majority of the people were really struggling. And I think that really did impact me and it resonated with me. And I was like, well, access to nature is something that we should really look at now post-pandemic, during the pandemic, post-pandemic, because this is really emphasizing the need. This is emphasizing the disparity and the inequalities in access to nature. And so Grow to Know almost started by navigating the media in a way that gave the voice to those people that didn't have that access to nature.
Now, you want everybody to be involved in this journey. You have a new book just coming out, Small Space Revolution, with Dawling Kindersley. And it's a book that suggests that everybody should think about how we can collectively help to improve access to nature, especially, as you've described, for many people who need it for all sorts of reasons, for healing, for making a better society, maybe for escaping from an apartment that doesn't have any green space. Just tell us about the book and its ambition.
Yeah, of course. And I guess to complement that kind of childlike curiosity is very much about taking action and very much about creating a wider access point and different access points for people and actually realizing that there's a responsibility on those that are the kind of gatekeepers of space. And this can be a joyful, collaborative, creative way of engaging with people and communities and plants and places. I think there's opportunity everywhere and every day, whether that's like a rooftop garden or whether that's a back garden or a communal space. And I think, if anything, this book is all about activating your activism and getting people motivated and inspired to really take that action, whether it's stepping into a space that they haven't been in before, going to a park, or even drawing on my experiences with my mum and observing nature and understanding your landscape. But then also, how do you get your hands in the soil? And, you know, looking at food security, looking at mental health, physical health and well-being, looking at air pollution and air quality. I mean, these are all things that thread through all of our lives. And I just think nature is that kind of common ground that we can all relate to, we can all resonate with. And so that is the language that I speak in the hope that I can try and bring people together and take positive action for purposeful change.
My thanks to Tayshan Hayden-Smith, and Small Space Revolution, Planting Seeds of Change in Your Community, is published by DK. You can pre-order your copies at dk.com. Even though spring has sprung here in the UK, Finland is a country that has winter cycling always top of mind. The Nordic nation is a world leader when it comes to winter cycling in its cities. So what can other municipalities learn from Finland when it comes to getting around by bike in the winter months? Monocle's contributing editor, Sheena Roster, attended this year's Winter Cycling Congress in Edmonton, Canada, to find out if more cities are taking Finland's lead to get more people on their bikes during the chill of winter.
Now, there aren't many places you can go to where people are going to get excited about a city called Oulu. Never heard of it? Well, it's a mid-sized city in northern Finland, and it's unofficially the winter cycling capital of the world. With more than 900 kilometers of bike paths linking the sprawling city of about 200,000 people, it's estimated that about 42% of the city's residents cycle. And in the wintertime, about 10% of all trips made around the city happen on a bike. But here at the 11th Winter Cycling Congress held here in Edmonton, Canada, Oulu is a city that's all the rage. A room packed with conference goers all came here to listen to Timo Perala. He's from the Network of Finnish Cycling Municipalities, and he's giving a presentation. He explains how winter cycling culture started in Oulu.
Well, it starts from the late 1960s, actually. The city made the first ever car traffic plan. There was actually an American consultancy company or engineering company. They did a huge plan with huge intersections, and the city official got kind of scared of that. Like, okay, this is, seems like awful lot of money that we should build all this infrastructure. There was also the question of where should we put all the cyclists then and the pedestrians. And that was the trigger to do the first ever cycling network plan for the city of Oulu in 1972. And we were lucky to have a really visionary traffic engineer at the time. He just did the plan in such way that all the places in Oulu are really easy to reach by bike. And even the access is more convenient, faster by bike than by car. So I think that was kind of the seed for the success.
So why is it popular to cycle in the winter in Oulu? Well, it's really about the maintenance. Bike paths there are plowed daily at 6 a.m. And in a city that regularly snows, it's compacted down during large snowfall. I'll let Harley Verala, a traffic engineer for the city of Oulu, who's responsible for all things cycling in that city, explain more.
In most cases, we are not targeting for removing all the snow from the asphalt, so we are not targeting for bare asphalt, but we are plowing the snow, and quite often it kind of creates a thin layer of hard packed snow. In typical Finnish and typical Oulu winter condition, the temperature stays below minus 0 Celsius degrees, which basically means that the snow itself, the hard packed snow itself, provides good enough grip for whatever kind of tires you have on your bicycle. And in practice, most of the people in Oulu, they are not really using any kind of winter tires, no any kind of spikes on tires, but just the regular summer tires.
So what's stopping other cities from getting their residents to get around on bike in the winter? Well, studies have confirmed that it's actually poor infrastructure and maintenance that prevent people from cycling rather than the cold weather and snow. Encouraging cycling has actually proven to be cost-effective. For example, one analysis in Calgary, Canada, found that the driving cost throughout the city is actually 10 times more per kilometer traveled by car compared to cycling. Another study showed that Danish society gains more money for each kilometer cycled due to the primary health benefits, and they lose money for every kilometer driven. But just because Canada is full of winter cities, it doesn't mean that the Finnish model will translate into winter cycling here.
Everywhere is different. We treat winter differently culturally, through governance and design, in every different place.
That's Danielle Soneff. She's a graduate student at the University of Alberta, where she studies winter city design and governance. Even though Edmonton is the host city for the Winter Cycling Congress this year, it has many kilometers of bike lanes, but because these bike lanes aren't separated from the traffic network, it doesn't mean that it gets cleared like they can do in Finland. And for many planners here, the winter cycling maintenance is a barrier for many people to cycle.
Maintenance is basically governed by the bylaws and the political will that we have to do it.
But she says when it comes to working out how those bike lanes get cleared, there are lessons to learn.
I think one of the best lessons that we can take away from Finland is how when they were doing their maintenance contracts, they wrote into it that the city maintenance teams and the private contractors had to ride each other's path networks in like a friendly competition sort of way to figure out exactly who's delivering the best model.
And Danielle says we can learn lessons in design as well from Finnish cycling networks.
And I think one of the best lessons that I've seen from a design perspective is the projector systems that they use to delineate paths. So it's actually a light that goes onto the path that says this is where you walk and this is where you bike. No matter the substrate, you get to see that wayfinding.
But in other parts of Finland, it's seen as a health concern as well to get people on bikes. In the south of the country, winter cycling starts as part of the culture for children as young as daycare. Here's Stella Altonen, a project manager for the city of Tukaru for the cycling program.
The more we are able to have the young people getting the habit of cycling and also enabling their parents to actually speed up in the speed of the kids, and also the parents to trust that their kid is adequately skilled and able to do it. That's one part of being safe also in a traffic. So I think it's part of the getting the habit and the skills and the ability. I think these are very important skills that you need to get as early as possible into your daily rhythms.
Of course, every city is different. Different local economies, the land use, different culture and history, these are all factors that play into consideration when major cities are planning changes to their winter cycling networks. As Timo puts it, you can't just translate what Finns have done with winter cycling into any city.
We've seen many times there's a lot of cities who want to copy something from Oulu, but you have to do your homework first. Know what makes your city tick. Do we have the right people? Do we have skill set? Do we have political will, mandate? Do we have the funding, the money? So there's a lot of issues you have to really think about first before you start doing all in your city.
For Monocle Radio in Edmonton, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
We end today in Austria, where the government plans to introduce a nationwide vacancy tax on owners of empty properties. Four of the country's nine states are already charging a fee on empty homes, but the proposed new legislation would grant the same powers to the other five and also authorise regional governments to set the rates as they see fit. The idea has predictably drawn criticism from some politicians and homeowners, but its supporters say that it would bring as many as 650,000 homes across the country back into use, a vast number for any nation, especially one with just 9 million people. Monocle's Alexei Korolyov reports from Vienna, where the measure would target around 80,000 apartments.
Vienna's authorities are rightly proud of their housing policies. Although property prices are on the rise, rents remain affordable, especially in public and subsidized housing. But just like in the rest of the country, there are supply problems.
The city of Vienna is growing. We had approximately over the last 10 years 200,000 new inhabitants, people coming to Vienna looking for flats. And to have the housing market and the affordability of housing like in a balance, the city needs around 10,000 new available or newly built flats per year.
Peter Kraus is a Vienna city councillor and head of the Vienna branch of the Austrian Green Party. The Greens are a junior coalition partner in the country's national government, and have been among the most vocal champions of the vacancy tax. Councillor Kraus explains how the tax is going to work.
Different cities in Austria are already preparing this. This would work in a way that we have a register of all the flats in Vienna. We have a register of all the, I forgot the word again.
Main residencies.
And then we know which flats don't have a main residency. Mm. And then this would actually be the list of flats we can say, okay, now we ask the owners of the flats, why is there no residency in this flat? Is there a reason? Refurbishment, change of usage, I don't know. If there's no reason, you have 6 months. And after 6 months, there's the vacancy fee. And the money we should use for refurbishment of old homes, of old buildings. Vienna has a very big part of old, also affordable flats. And we could use that money to subsidize refurbishment, renovation, also maybe the change from fossil fuels to renewable fuels. Those are all, I think, subsidies that also help to, on the one hand, make affordable housing quality-wise better, but also to safeguard affordable existing homes.
Needless to say, not everybody's on board. In Parliament, critics include the far-right Freedom Party, the third largest, and the Liberal Neos Party. Both say the tax would pose a threat to people's property rights and have called for a rethink, although they don't have the numbers to stop it from getting through. But there's opposition outside of Parliament too.
Jetzt hat man das den Ländern überlassen, weil sie es wollten, und sie können jetzt auf einmal auch sehr hohe Steuern auf Leerstand beziehen.
The Austrian Homeowners and Landowners Association has put out a statement that describes the proposal as part of the standard repertoire of left-wing ideologues. This despite the fact that the idea has been supported by the country's conservative chancellor, Karl Nehammer. Martin Brunbauer is head of the group, and he says he's having trouble with the very definition of vacancy.
Jetzt haben wir aber ein Problem mit dem Leerstand. Auf der einen Seite hat mir noch niemand erklären können, was Leerstand eigentlich ist.
Nobody has managed to explain to me what a vacant flat actually means, because there's many reasons for a flat to be empty. It may be about to be rented or sold. It can be in the process of refurbishment, which takes a long time. There's 1,000 other reasons. That's why I am convinced that owners have every right to keep their properties empty.
Das heißt, ich dürfte auch leer stehen lassen. Die Zahlen, die hier herumgeistern, sind einfach nicht wahr.
We have estimates of 80,000 flats in Vienna that are vacant right now.
Vienna City Councillor Peter Kraus is realistic about how many flats the tax would yield, but he still believes that it's the right thing to do.
If we talk about the 80,000 flats that are vacant, we estimate that we can mobilize like 50% of that, and that would add to those flats that are newly developed and newly built. Maybe some can't be mobilized, but it gets less attractive to have investment and business models that, for example, we have seen this in Vienna a lot, you can invest in flats, you never live there, the flat gets rented out on Airbnb, it's a whole business model, no one ever lives there except for touristic reasons, and this is on the ground of sites in the city that are designed for affordable housing. And this should not work. And in total, it would mean that the market is more open, that there are more flats available, and therefore the prices are going down or at least not rising that sharp or that fast.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. You can subscribe to the show on all good podcast platforms for new episodes every week. And you can also subscribe to Monocle magazine for regular reports on design, architecture and urbanism. Just visit monocle.com. The Urbanist is produced by Carlotta Ribello and by David Stevens, who also edits this show. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, City Lovers.